Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.
Nice to be back in Crowley. What is it now? Is it the 16th already?
Yeah.
April 16th. Okay. Well, Daishi wanted me to talk about problems. Is that all right with everybody? Can we talk about problems? Obstacles? Okay. Well, probably none of you have any problems or obstacles in your life, but maybe we could talk about this as far as helping other people. I mean, we might think Krishna consciousness is natural. It's the natural position of the soul, and the main person who would like us to be Krishna conscious and go back to Godhead is... Who's the main person who really would like us to go back to Godhead and be Krishna conscious? Krishna! Prabhupada says he's 10 times more anxious for us to go back than we are to go back. Because he knows that if we're in our original position, that we'll be so much happier. So you might say, well, why isn't it easier then? I was speaking to some business persons at Ernst & Young the other night. And they said, oh, this spiritual path, that's just the easy way, right? Then you don't have to work so hard like everybody else. I said, no, actually, it's kind of challenging. But you ever wonder about that? Why doesn't Krishna just make everything easy? Why doesn't you just say, okay, Hare Krishna, I surrender to Krishna, I want to be Krishna conscious, and then poof. I mean, it can be. Prabhupada sometimes says you can be Krishna conscious in a moment. But for most of us, it doesn't take just a moment. It seems to take a long time. And Krishna says, for most people, it takes a long time. Do you all know that verse? Bahunam janmanam mante yanamamam papadnite vasudevam sarvaniti samahatma sudurlabha. Bahunam. Bahunam means, bahu means what? Bahu. Many. Bahunam janmanam. Janma means? What does janma mean? Birth. Ante. The end. So, the end of many, many births. Gyanamamam prapadyate. You actually have real knowledge. Ah, let there be light. So, Krishna says that generally it takes many, many births.
I'm sorry.
Oh, thank you. So again, you might wonder, what's the problem? Why are there so many obstacles? Why don't we first look at what is an obstacle? What's an obstacle?
Yeah. Not having time. Not
what?
Having enough time.
Not having enough time. That's an example of an obstacle, yeah? Something that stops you from doing the service you want to do? Or something that makes the service difficult? Makes your service difficult or that stops you entirely. And some of the obstacles are external to ourselves. And some of the obstacles are inside ourselves. Is that correct? So sometimes my obstacle is my own emotions or my own desires. And sometimes the obstacles are other responsibilities that I have. What about other people? Are other people often obstacles to our spiritual life? I've noticed also that most of us tend to think that our particular obstacles are really great, and also generally that they're really special and nobody can really understand what our obstacles are. And I've asked this of many people. Is there anyone here who has no obstacles to their spiritual life at all, either inside or outside? Yeah. So I've asked this of many groups, and no one so far has said, no, there's no external or internal obstacles to my spiritual life. So one thing that we can remember is that everybody has obstacles in this world. Everyone. And we tend to think my particular obstacles are especially difficult, insurmountable, painful. No one else understands what I have to go through. But really, each person has their own story. And maybe that person doesn't have your obstacles, but then they have other things. And everyone is carrying something. In fact, I'd say most people have more than one thing that makes spiritual life difficult for them. And the place where there's no obstacles, of course, is the spiritual world. In the spiritual world, there's no obstacles. There's no difficulties. So one set of obstacles we have is just nature itself. Because this whole creation has a dual purpose. It has the purpose of facilitating the illusion of being separate from Krishna and being an independent controller. That's what it exists for. It's just like a movie theater exists to show movies that make you forget your life. That's why people go to movies. They want to forget their own life and be absorbed in a fantasy life. So a movie theater is not a very good place to think about your own personal life. It doesn't really facilitate that. So this world, it's a world of illusion. It's kind of like a great big movie or a great big computer game or a great big collective dream. One of my friends recently wrote something. I need a break from reality. I said, the whole material world is a break from reality. So we've come here by our own desire. And so in one sense, you could say that that block from the material energy is really coming from us, because I'm the one who wants to be in the material energy. But still, the material energy is really, it's offering facility, or we could say she's offering facility, for us to forget Krishna. Now, the material energy is also designed to facilitate devotional service, but not quite the same way as the spiritual energy is designed to facilitate devotional service. So everything here is, everything you do in the material world is a struggle. In the spiritual world, as kalpa viksha laksha abhriteshu, there's desire trees. Whatever you want, you just go to a tree and ask. There's no struggle, there's no work. Whereas in this world, anything you want to achieve, I mean, you want to cook a meal, you have to plan the meal, you have to shop, you have to bring it home, you have to put it away, you have to clean things and cut them and clean the pots, and so many things just for the, you know, 20 minutes of eating, right? So many hours of planning and cooking and cleaning up just for something simple. Or you just want to have a nice room or a nice house. And how much you have to work to get the money to pay for the house, and then you've got to worry about painting the walls and keeping the place clean and taking care of the plumbing, and right? So much just to have a little shelter from the weather, just to have a shelter from the weather and insects and thieves, then you can relax in. And so much work. So even doing something for Krishna in this world, everything takes a lot of work. Putting on a festival, or whatever you want to do. Even making an arrangement just to sit and chant takes some work. So that's how nature is designed. Because this world is designed for people who want to operate separately from Krishna, therefore they're kind of on their own. If you want to cooperate with the truth, everything is naturally provided. If you don't want to cooperate with the truth, then you have to struggle. Something like, if you're swimming in a river, if you swim with the current, it's easy. If you swim against the current, it's a struggle. So it's not that Krishna's designed the world to make a struggle, but we're swimming against the current. Our mood is that we're swimming against the current, so we find everything a struggle. So part of it is material nature. And then, of course, part of it is also our own past karma, our own desires, our own offenses, our own dealing improperly with other living beings. And we'll get into that a little bit, how that manifests. And generally, we don't think that our obstacles in spiritual life are coming at all from us. Generally, we think, you know, I just want to be spiritual, I want to be a devotee of Krishna, but there's all these problems and I'm kind of a victim. And one way of dealing with obstacles is to say, wait a minute, I'm really responsible for the fact that there's any obstacle. Even just the fact that I'm in the material world where there's volcanoes and there's rain, you know, I'm the one who came here. Now, there is a source of obstacles that is Krishna. There is a third source of obstacles, which is Krishna. But we'll talk about how those obstacles, which are coming from Krishna, are only obstacles from our perspective. They're really not obstacles at all. They're really facilitating our spiritual life, and we're just not perceiving them that way. So I want to go through a list of how we can make the best use of obstacles, and then we'll compare the view of the materialistic person with the view of the devotee as far as obstacles goes. And I'm sure there's more. I make kind of a list here, but I'm sure there's more than this. These are just the ones I could find by going through the scriptures. So one purpose we can make of, one good use we can make of obstacles. Actually, I'll start with this quote. It's from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 6, Chapter 4, Text 27 to 28. And Prabhupada says, being pleased with the devotee, the Lord turns all his material impediments into spiritual service. So the obstacles themselves become service. So how is that possible? So let's look at some ways that could be possible. Well, one way is that the obstacle can be an opportunity for us to show our sincerity. It's easy to be sincere when everything's going well. I remember someone telling me a story about their parents. They were saying how their mother, as she got older, got a kind of dementia, kind of like Alzheimer's, but much worse. And she became severely psychotic. So she couldn't recognize anyone in her family. She was often had hallucinations. She'd think people were chasing her. She only slept about 2 hours a night. And this person was telling me how their father became completely exhausted caring for her. You know, he himself couldn't sleep, and she was always, like, taking the clothes out of the closet and causing a disturbance. And at one point he thought, I just need to put her in a home somewhere. I just can't take care of her anymore. And after he dropped her off, he thought, when I married her, I took a vow for better or for worse, but I'm not doing that. I only want to take care of her when it's better. And after a few days, he went and got her back, and he was eventually able to cure her, which was another interesting story, because basically she was incurable, and she was able to be cured. But what really struck me was that he thought, when I married this person, I married her for better or for worse. I didn't expect it was going to be this bad, but I can't abandon her. I have to still try to take care of her. And that's what we know when we really have friends, isn't it? If we have friends when we have money and we have health and we're having a good time, but you really have friends when you're poor, when you're sick, when your life's falling apart. So the obstacles in our life are a way for us to show Krishna that really what I care about is you. I care about loving you. I don't care about what you can do for me or how easy my life is, but how much I can show my love for you. And what's really interesting is that we're often making the most advancement during the times that we feel like we're struggling most. If you've taken a vow to chant 16 rounds, and, you're really, really sick, and there's all these emergencies in your life, and there you are at 11 o'clock at night, barely keeping your eyes open, thinking, I made this promise, I'm going to chant, and they're lousy rounds, I can't even think, I can't even keep my eyes open, I'm practically falling over asleep, but somehow I'm going to finish my rounds, Krishna. That's much more showing your love for Krishna than if you're in some circumstance where it's easy, and you're feeling ecstasy, and it shows more that I love. That I'm in love with Krishna. I'm not just in love with the ecstasy. I'm not just in love with the circumstances. And we understand this, as I say, materially. In fact, most of us take pride. Not a bad kind of pride, a good kind of pride. Most of us take pride in the sacrifices we've done for people that we love. We think, I did this. I did that for someone that I love. I worked extra hours. I had to work 3 jobs just to take care of my family. Your father was just telling us that. Mm-hmm. When I came here, I didn't have anything, but I had the children, and so I had to work 2 and 3 jobs. And he has a sense of satisfaction out of that. Why? Because that's how you demonstrate love. What he's feeling satisfaction from is he's remembering, there was so much love. So when we're dealing with some obstacle, Even doing this much in a situation where there's an obstacle is a demonstration of love. Then another use we can make of obstacles is to see that they're purifying us of our bad qualities. And we'll get into this a little bit more later. But this is coming from the understanding that I'm often the one who's creating this obstacle. And this obstacle is reflecting back at me what I need to deal with. So it can be an impetus to change our behavior, to change our attitude, to change our thoughts. You know, we can go on thinking, well, yeah, I got this together and that together and this together and that together, and I'm a really good devotee and I'm so spiritual and I'm so this and I'm so that. And it may look like that if everything's easy. Right? If nobody does anything to insult you or disturb you, you may think, oh, I'm free of anger. Isn't that a fact? And you might think like that for a year or two. Wow, I haven't gotten angry at anybody for a couple years. Wow, I guess I don't have any anger anymore. And then somebody doesn't and comes and does something and you're, and all of a sudden, whoa, where'd that come from? So these obstacles and difficulties are ways for us to see, wait a minute, this is something I still have to work on. In that sense, they act as an exam. You know, why does a teacher give an exam? So an ordinary teacher gives an exam so the teacher can know what your strengths and challenges are. But Krishna already knows that. So one reason he gives us exam is so I can see, oh, this is the area that I have to work on. This is something that needs my attention. And this other one is really deep. So that we can learn to take pleasure in Krishna's satisfaction. That's really the essence of bhakti yoga, is that my pleasure becomes Krishna's satisfaction. And again, we all understand this on a material level. We've all had circumstances where we love somebody so much, we cared about somebody so much, that we were doing something to make them happy and we weren't even thinking about ourselves while we were doing it. We just didn't think about it. You know, while we're cleaning the house or while we're cooking the meal or while we're working at the job or while we're driving, whatever it is we're doing for someone that we love, all we're thinking about is, oh, I hope they're happy, I hope they're happy, I hope they're happy, I hope they're happy. You know, I hope when my wife comes back and sees the new car I bought that she'll be happy. That's all you're thinking. I hope my wife's happy. I hope my husband's happy. I hope my child is happy. I hope my mother is happy. And you lose yourself and you don't even notice practically the sacrifices and the austerities that you're making. And again, you take pride in the obstacles that you have. You're happy. Wow, there was this obstacle and that obstacle. I saw this recently with somebody who went to buy a wheelchair for a friend of theirs who'd had an accident. And to get the wheelchair, she had to take a train, and she had to go to a city she'd never been in before, and she had to find where to buy it and ask all these people, and there were so many obstacles. And when she came back, she was happy about the obstacles. Oh, if it had just been easy, it wouldn't have been actually so much fun for her. Does that make sense? And she was just focused on, oh, I'm taking care of my friend. And the whole reason she's doing it, oh, my friend can have the wheelchair that she needs. So generally, our focus in the world is ourselves and how comfortable I am, how nice people are to me. Right? We're not generally thinking, how can I make Krishna happy? You know, we're just thinking, how does my family member treat me? How do the other people at work treat me? What's my health like? How much money do I have? What kind of living situation do I have? And I'm often thinking, okay, let's see, I need the perfect situation to serve Krishna. So that means that my spouse has to completely support my Krishna consciousness, my children have to support my Krishna consciousness, my mother and father have to support my Krishna consciousness, I have to get the kind of job that supports my Krishna consciousness, I have to live in the country that supports my Krishna consciousness, I have to arrange my home perfectly, I have to have enough money. So so that I can spend time doing this and that for Krishna, and I have to have good health so I can do this for Krishna. Right? And we're really thinking much more about how am I going to be comfortable doing my service for Krishna, rather than am I pleasing Krishna? And materialistic people are generally thinking, you know, okay, I want to be comfortable. I want my family members, the people at work, the people I associate with, to all treat me nicely. I want my body to work properly. I want my home to be comfortable so I can enjoy the world. And if we're thinking, well, I want all those things so I can serve Krishna, it ends up being practically the same thing. So I can serve, so I can be comfortable. So it's going to be easy for me to serve. And one way you can tell what the real motive is when those things don't go right, you get angry. Do you get frustrated? Do you blame the people and the circumstances around you for your lack of Krishna consciousness? If only my husband was supportive, then I could really be a devotee. It's all his fault. Oh, so these obstacles are a way for us to look at what's my real motive? What's really what's important to me? Am I thinking just about my own comfort, or am I thinking about Krishna? Do I actually have love? And I should have printed it out. I didn't think of it till now. I will do it next time. There is a very wonderful letter that Srila Prabhupada wrote one devotee who asked for permission to leave his wife. He said, I want to leave my wife so that I can concentrate more on preaching and be renounced. And you know, I made a mistake. I shouldn't have gotten married. And Prabhupada said, so you got married whimsically and now you want to leave whimsically. He said, just consider. He said, even if it was a mistake, how are you going to solve it with another mistake? He said, the neophyte devotee generally thinks that the circumstances under which difficulties occurred are the cause of their difficulties. The neophyte devotee generally thinks that the circumstances under which the difficulties arose are the cause of their difficulties. He said, but that is not a fact. He said, the reason that you're having problems with your wife is your own lack of Krishna consciousness. He said, whatever situation you're in, you should use that to serve Krishna. He said, this is not, we're not asking you, he said, to do some ordinary dharma. He said, just like Arjuna, after hearing from Krishna, he decided to continue with his normal occupation of being a soldier, but not because he was interested in materialistic dharma or materialistic duties, but to make Krishna happy. That was his service for Krishna. He said, so the whole point is service for Krishna. And if you're serving Krishna, what does it matter what the circumstances are? It doesn't matter. Whatever circumstances you're in, do that. He said, that doesn't mean that you can just do anything whimsically and say, okay, now I'm doing this as service for Krishna. That you do what Krishna advises, even if it's difficult. So I thought now we could just do a general comparison over how a materialistic person and a devotee sees difficulties in their life. So a materialistic person basically sees their happiness as all coming from things that are external to them. I'm happy if I have enough money. I'm happy if I have a family that treats me nicely the way I want. You know, I have my list. My wife should do this, my husband should do this, my parents should do this. I'm happy if I have a job that's exciting. I'm happy if my boss is considerate and my coworkers are considerate, if I live in a place with decent weather, if I have a nice enough house, if I have a nice car. If I have these things, then I'm happy, and if I don't, then I'm unhappy. And their idea is, the materialistic person's idea is, that if I'm unhappy, I'm going to change something in my circumstances. I'm going to try to fix it. I'll try to fix my boss. I'll try to fix my spouse. I'll try to fix my health. I'll try to fix my home. I'll try to fix my job. I'll change something around me. And the view of the materialist is, as soon as I get everything perfect, then I'll be happy. Now, there's several problems with this approach. What are some of the problems with this approach to life? You're not going to get perfection. That's the biggest problem. The biggest problem is it's never going to work. It may seem like it works for 5 minutes or a week, maybe. You know, you're getting along great with your family members. Everything's going wonderfully at work. You got enough money in the bank. You like your house. You like your car. You like your neighborhood. The sun is shining. And you think, ah, it's perfect. Recently read a story like that about a man who had gotten to that point in his life. Just bought a new house. Loved his job. Loved his car. Getting along well with his family. Good health. Plenty of money. And as he's moving into his new house, he trips on the stairs, has an accident, and becomes paralyzed for life. So, why? Just when it was perfect. So one of the problems is that it's hard to get everything perfect. Everything doesn't stay perfect. As soon as you get everything perfect, then, you know, the toilet breaks. Something happens. Right? Your kid gets in an argument with their teacher at school, or you get a new boss, or something that breaks the perfection, isn't it? You can't keep it perfect. And then you have to make another adjustment, and then you have to make another adjustment, and you have to make another adjustment. And for most of us, we don't even have a week where it's all perfect. You know, it's hard to even get to a point where it's perfect for 5 minutes or a week. And then how do you keep it that way? So that's one big problem, is that you can't really do that. Everything in this world is always changing. Okay, what's another problem with that approach to happiness?
You want more.
Yeah, you always want more. That even if you have perfection, you get tired of it. So let's say you had perfection and you could keep it, which is not going to happen. But let's just say, theoretically, after a while it's not perfect anymore. The research shows that however much money a person's earning, they always want to earn 10% more. I forget what the psychologists call that. There's a term for it. Where you basically become conditioned by whatever you have. You get used to it. You have your perfect house with your own swimming pool. But after a while, it's just where you live. It doesn't seem special to you anymore. It doesn't give you any kind of thrill anymore. And then again, you have to get something new. What is another problem with that approach to life?
It's all external, isn't it?
It's all external. It's all external. And of course, this is, you're getting to the one of the deepest existential problems with thinking that our happiness is from things outside of us. It doesn't touch us. And the analogy Prabhupada gives is the bird in the cage. You ever seen a bird in a cage? Am I boring you? You ever seen a bird in a cage? Suppose you just polished the cage and you didn't feed the bird. What would happen to the poor little bird? It would die. So all the things outside of us in our life, they don't really touch us. Which is why on those moments when you think it's perfect, after a little while you go, is that it? Okay. Is that it? I did it? I've been wanting to do this and wanting to do this and wanting to do it and planning it and meditating on it, and I do it. And then I go, that's it? Somehow there's no depth to it. Have you noticed that? That material happiness doesn't have really a depth. It's very surface. I mean, if material happiness really made you happy, then let's say 95% of people who had wealth, beauty, intelligence, fame, would be happy. Is that true, that 95% of people who have those things are happy? No. I don't know what the percentage is, but, you know, a lot of those people get divorced, they commit suicide, they take a lot of intoxication. I mean, if those things brought happiness, you'd expect to see the vast majority of people who had those things would be unbelievably happy. And that certainly is not the case. Why? They're not touching the self. No, they're external. I mean, so many accounts of people who are, you know, worldwide famous, unbelievably rich, seemingly the perfect spouse, perfect house, perfect job, and you find out they're addicted to drugs. Right? Or they're engaged in some activity That's indicative that they're not happy. And not all, of course. But we would really expect that those things would give the vast majority of people who have them happiness. It's something like happiness in a dream. You ever eaten food in a dream? You ever eaten food in a dream? And sometimes at some point in the dream you say, something's funny here. I remember once when I was drinking water in a dream, and in the dream I was drinking jugs of water, you know, cup after cup after cup. And at some point in the dream, I said, why am I still thirsty? Yeah. So material life is like that. You're eating food, you're drinking water, and it's like, something's funny here. I'm still not satisfied. Any other reasons why this just doesn't work?
We don't know what we want.
We don't know what we really want, yeah. We're going for the wrong goals. Or I could say, we know what we want, but we're going about it in the wrong way. So we know we want happiness, and we think what we want is money. Money is just a tool. Or we think what we want is education. We're looking for happiness, we're looking for security, we're looking for peace, we're looking for communication, we're looking for understanding, we're looking for meaning, we're looking for adventure. So it's very tempting in spiritual life to take the same kind of attitude, to say, my Krishna consciousness, so the materialist is saying, my happiness is dependent on the arrangement that I make within the world. And if I could make a perfect arrangement and keep it, I'd be happy. Which, as we just saw, anybody who thinks about this logically for half an hour would see that that's an untenable assumption. I mean, of course, people don't sit down and think about it logically for half an hour. And we're in a society that's constantly bombarding us with the idea that that's the reality. Just arrange your circumstances. Just buy this car. Just buy this insurance. Just have this kind of relationship. Just have this kind of, you know, color hair. And then you'll be happy. And we're just constantly, you know, even from our childhood, our parents are even telling us, just go to the right school, get the right grades, have the right job, marry the right person, live in the right neighborhood. You will be happy. And then taking up spiritual life, we often bring in the same thing. Rupa Goswami says that there are weeds near the bhakti creeper and they can look just like bhakti. And we're thinking, if I could just retire early, go live in Vrindavan, or live in the ashram and just preach, then I'd be Krishna conscious. My dear friends, it's the same thing. It's the same mentality. We're basically taking the same mentality, bringing it into spiritual life, and coating it with a little spirituality. If I could just adjust my life, if I could just make my life perfect. Here we're thinking if I could make it perfect for sense gratification. Here we're thinking if I could just make it perfect for Krishna consciousness, then I'd be happy. But Krishna consciousness is not about making your life perfect for Krishna consciousness. It's about making your heart perfect for Krishna consciousness. And I'm convinced that one of the reasons that Krishna often doesn't allow us to make our lives perfect externally for Krishna consciousness is so that we have to focus on what is the real thing. Again, if there's nobody in your life who gets you annoyed, you'll think that you're not angry. You'll think, I'm just a very peaceful person. And you won't do the real thing that you need to do to become happy. So Krishna consciousness is not a series of activities. That's not what Krishna consciousness is. It's not just, okay, I move my fingers on the bead and I say these words and I move the ghee lamp and I, you know. It's not a series of activities. It's a change of heart. And the series of activities are meant to do two things. To help us develop that change of heart and as we develop it to express that change of heart. That's what the series of activities are meant for. So our perspective on our obstacles and difficulties should be radically different from that of the materialist. Yes?
Why
yes, of course, we would like to try to arrange our lives as far as possible to facilitate our Krishna consciousness, of course. If I love somebody, I want to try to arrange my life so that I can be with them as much as I can, naturally. But love is sometimes developed more when there's difficulties in being with somebody. Love is not always developed most in the easy situations. In fact, going through a crisis with somebody often develops a bond much more than going through fun times with them. Some of the people that we're closest to are the people that we've been through some crisis with, people that we've shared some difficulty with. And you see, this happens, by the way, even in the spiritual world, that Krishna creates these illusions of difficulties and obstacles even there. Why is Krishna's relationship with the gopis apparently that of unmarried love? Because then there's obstacles. There's no question of morality in the spiritual world. There's no rules. Everybody's perfectly moral. But Krishna creates this illusion of immorality. Why? Because your love expands more when you apparently have to overcome obstacles. And when you overcome obstacles with someone that you love. So the devotees have several things that they think of when they see these obstacles. I mean, first of all, I should say that, yes, again, I'm going to repeat it again. We should try to arrange our life to facilitate our spiritual life. Definitely. But as we said in the beginning, can we do that perfectly all the time? No, can't. Just like the materialists can't perfectly arrange their life for their sense gratification, we're not going to be able to perfectly arrange our life to become Krishna conscious. If you spend all of your time trying to arrange your life to become Krishna conscious, instead of becoming Krishna conscious, you'd be wasting your energy. My own suggestion is that put 10% of your energy into arranging your life to become Krishna conscious and put 90% of your energy into being Krishna conscious in the situation that you have. So if there's things that you can make arrangements for, if there's ways that you can adjust your sleeping schedule or where you live or what kind of job that you have as to facilitate your Krishna consciousness, definitely you should do that. But if there's things that you can't arrange, or if you find yourself just putting all your energy to arranging, then how do we deal with the obstacles that we can't get out of our way? So one thing is then to think, well, do I love Krishna just when it's pleasing, or do I love Krishna in all circumstances? How am I going to express my love for Krishna in the circumstance that I have? I really like the story of Gajendra. You all know the story of Gajendra, the elephant? So he had been a great devotee, and he was engaged in a meditative trance. There's a number of stories like this. And in this trance, you know, in a yogic trance, you pull your senses back from their objects. So a person in yogic trance doesn't see or hear anything in the world. It's something like when you're dreaming, when you're sleeping and dreaming, you don't perceive anything external. So a yogic trance is something like a controlled dream, where you don't perceive, you don't hear or see anything in the world, and you're meditating on Krishna in your heart. So he didn't hear anything, and one sage came by and asked him, I forget what it was for, it was for water. Anyway, he didn't respond. And the sage got very angry. He said, you're just like an animal. You should just take birth as an elephant. So in his next life, he took birth as an elephant. But he remembered his past life as a devotee. Anyway, as an elephant, one time he went to go drink some water. And when he went into a lake to drink water, a crocodile attacked him and was biting his leg. And he was trying to get out from the crocodile. The crocodile wasn't able to kill him because the elephant was very strong. But the crocodile was keeping him in the water. So evidently the crocodile was able to kind of eat a little bit, even though he had the elephant's leg in his mouth. If some fish or something could go into his mouth. But the elephant couldn't eat because he's in the water. He couldn't get any food. He's getting weaker and weaker and weaker. And he was in a lot of pain. I mean, it must be painful, right? To have a crocodile biting your leg. Would that hurt? Yeah, I think it would hurt a lot. If a mosquito bites my foot, it hurts. What to speak of a crocodile. So he was in a lot of pain. So externally, his circumstance for spiritual life was not very good. He didn't have anything to eat. He's in pain. Plus, he's an animal body. And he remembered prayers that he knew in his previous life. And he started saying these prayers. and asking for the Lord to help him. And at a certain point, Lord Vishnu comes on Garuda. And Gajendra, he was very, very weak, and he was in terrible pain. But with great difficulty, he took a lotus flower from the lake in his trunk, and he held it up as an offering. So he couldn't offer much. He couldn't do much. But what he did with love. So it's how can I demonstrate love for Krishna in this circumstance? Maybe I'm lying in bed with a fever. I can't do anything. But what can I do? Is there something that I can do? There's a friend of mine who's has a lifetime disease where she's periodically becomes bedridden and can't walk and is dependent on other people to take care of her. So she has times when she can be active, and although she can never be fully active, and then times when she's bedridden and paralyzed. And she said to me, what can I do when I'm just lying in bed? I can't move. And I said, well, what service would you really like to do? She said, I'd really like to dress the deities in Mayapur. I wish I could dress the Panchatattva deities in Mayapur. I said, well, then you can meditate. There's a nice story in the Nectar Devotion about a brahmana who was very poor, but he heard about how Krishna likes to be offered very opulent preparations in gold and silver bowls, and that if you could do it in meditation, it would also count. So every day he would do that. Every day he would sit down, and he would just meditate on himself going to the Jamuna and the Ganga, and taking pots of gold and silver and filling them with Jamuna water and Ganga water. And then he'd meditate on himself carrying them back to the temple and massaging the deity with oil and then bathing the deity with the Ganga and Jamuna water and then cooking a whole feast for the deity and offering this. And he'd spend quite some time in meditation like this every day. And he did this for many, many years, every single day. And one time in his meditation, he was making some sweet rice. And he wanted to offer it, but he thought, well, you're not supposed to offer sweet rice when it's hot. I have to wait till it cools. So he touched it with the edge of his finger to see if it was cool. And in his meditation, he burned his finger. And he immediately came out of his meditation and saw that his finger was actually burnt. His physical finger was burnt. At this time in Vaikuntha, the Lord started laughing. Mm-hmm. And Lakshmi Devi said, why are you laughing? And he immediately sent an airplane to bring this devotee back to the spiritual world. And Prabhupada says in many, many places throughout Bhagavatam and in Chaitanya Charitamrita that we can meditate on performing service to the Lord. Now, obviously, if you have real gold and silver dishes, then use those. It's not that you offer Krishna paper plates and you meditate on gold. So if you can afford gold, buy it. But if you can't afford gold, you can meditate on that. And this is true across the board. If there's some service that you'd like to do, you really want to do, and there's circumstances in your life that prevent you from doing them, you can meditate on doing them. And Krishna accepts that service the same. Now, maybe all the other devotees won't accept it the same. Maybe you won't get written up in the temple newsletter, but you'll get written up in Krishna's newsletter. And he accepts that equally. And what's really nice about doing service in meditation is you can do really special service in meditation. And you can offer your deities outfits covered with jewels. You can build a temple made of jewels. You can distribute 10 million books. You can make an IMAX 3D movie about the Mahabharata. And whatever it is you want to do. In fact, it's in the Shastra it says that whenever we worship the deity, we should worship a deity both externally and in meditation. So you can do both. If you're making an offering at home on your altar, and like they're offering some melon, 3 pieces of melon on a paper plate. Okay, everybody see the 3 pieces of melon on a paper plate there on the altar? And some pretty, those look like real flowers, okay, but they're pretty simple flowers. So when you're putting those flowers on the altar, whoever's putting the flowers on the altar, you can meditate while you're putting the flowers on the altar. I'm giving you gardenias and roses and jasmine flowers, even though that's not really physically what you're putting on the altar. Does that make sense? You can meditate. I'm giving you a golden plate, and on this golden plate, what would we like to offer? We could offer, well, the cantaloupe could be cut out. You could cut the rinds off the cantaloupe, cut them into little pieces, and they could be in a golden bowl. Then you could have another golden bowl with really nice strawberries, not those ones that look good and don't have any taste. You know, really sweet strawberries, maybe with cream on them. And then raspberries. What about some mango, pineapple? I don't know if you guys have ever had golden kiwi. I had those in New Zealand. They taste like ice cream. Golden kiwi, and then whatever whatever you'd really like to offer. Samosas, homemade ice cream, and offer that in meditation. So while you're offering the cantaloupe on the paper plate, mentally, you're offering a golden plate with all the different preparations on it that you want. So this idea, Prabhupada often says, actually there's one place where Prabhupada says, chanting Hare Krishna means to make a diamond throne in your heart and bathe Krishna with Ganga and Jamuna water and offer him garments and ornaments. Prabhupada also sometimes talks about having that kind of meditation while you're chanting. But anything that we're doing for Krishna, we can expand what we're doing through meditation. And if you can't do anything, you can meditate on doing so. Yes?
Clarify a bit more on meditation. What exactly do you mean by meditation? That's one question I have. And the other question was, if you offer something in a golden plate or whatever, obviously, is that not that being materialistic?
Okay, that's a good question. I'll answer your second question first. So, Krishna's not interested whether it's a gold plate or a paper plate. It doesn't make any difference to him. First of all, Krishna owns all the wealth in the world already. And in one sense, he is everything in the world already. He doesn't own it, he is it. So it's already him. It's already his or it's already him. So that doesn't matter. But if you love somebody, you naturally want to give them the best thing. So again, the activities we do are for two purposes. They're to develop love and to express love. So if I want to develop my love for somebody, one of the things I might do is buy them flowers, right? Or I might buy them something valuable, isn't it? Something beautiful, something valuable. That's one way to both grow love and to express love. And if you really love someone, you want to give them nice food. And you want to give them nice food in a beautiful setting. They say that at a meal, a poor family will ask, did you get enough? A middle-class family will ask, did you like it? And the wealthy family will ask, did you appreciate the setting and the service? So we want to give everything to Krishna. We want to give Krishna enough of things that are tasty in a beautiful setting because we love him, not because he needs it. And Krishna is not interested in the external. He's interested in the love. And when you're doing this through meditation, you're not even doing it on the gross platform at all. You're doing it on the subtle platform. But we should want to offer Krishna everything. Again, he already owns everything. What are we really offering? We're really offering our love. Krishna's not particularly interested in any of the external things that we do, except as a manifestation of love. My daughter-in-law's father told me that he really understood this one time when one of his sons, I think it was like 5 or 6, came to him and said, "Look, Daddy, look at this stick I found." And he felt overwhelming affection for his child, although the stick had no value. Just that his son wanted to give him something out of affection. But if we're going to give something, why not have it be the nicest thing? So I can think of how can I serve in the circumstances that I have? What can I do in the circumstances I have? What's the best service I can do? And I'll answer your other question later, because that'll be too far off topic and I'll get distracted. So with the obstacles that I have, what service can I do externally? What's the best service I can do externally with the constraints that I have? And then internally, mentally, I can go beyond my externals. Then, to always have an attitude of gratitude, but beyond gratitude. We'll start with gratitude, then we'll go beyond that. So first, being grateful to Krishna for whatever I do have. No matter how many obstacles and difficulties we have in our life, no one has a life of only obstacles. I mean, sometimes it may feel like that, but if we think about it, it's not like that. There's always something we're able to do. And we often take those things for granted. I mean, in December, I tripped on some stairs and broke my foot. And all of a sudden, I appreciated the ability to walk. And since then, I've become much more conscious that I can walk. So be grateful for what you have, whatever it is, even if it's only a little tiny thing that you have. Be grateful that you're human. Right, to find something to be grateful for. And again, that's part of saying, what can I do with what I have? Instead of, what can't I do with what I don't have? What can I do with what I have? Because really, it's all about, bhakti yoga is all about developing a relationship of love with the Supreme. It's not about doing X, Y, Z externally. It's not about, I can distribute this many books, or I build this many temples, or I do this many things, or I do this many things. It's about love. And if you're doing the most you can in your circumstances, that's much more an exhibition of love than someone who's doing a lot in a place where they could do a little. Then beyond gratitude, and this is a little tough, beyond gratitude to just appreciation of Krishna, even for the things that are obstacles. Not only just appreciating the things you have that you like and that make life easy, but appreciating everything. That everything is here for a reason. That everything I have is for my good, that God is truly all good and all merciful. And therefore, everything that I have, even the pain, even the difficulty, even the disappointments, are all ultimately for the good. And there's a very interesting story that I read about that. It was a group who was traveling in Africa, and as they sat down to have a lunch, one of the girls was attacked by killer bees. Are you familiar with killer bees? Now they've come to South America and they're coming into the United States. But there are a certain kind of honeybee in Africa that don't die when they sting. You know, most honeybees die when they sting. And the killer bees get angered very easily. And they'll basically swarm on a person for almost no reason. And it's very easy to die from the stings of killer bees. You know, normal honeybees don't get disturbed very much like that. So this girl was completely attacked by killer bees. They were in her hair, they were in her nose, in her ears, and she was gradually going into shock. And they had a few medical supplies with them, but not a whole lot. And the leader of the group just decided he was going to pray. And he started just saying, instead of just saying, Lord, please save this girl, he just started saying, thank you. Thank you, Lord, for the tree. Thank you for this. Thank you for that. And all of a sudden he said, and thank you for bees. And he was wondering, now, why did I say that? And as he said it, he felt overwhelming peace. And as he started saying that, he found that the bees left the girl and she regained consciousness. And not that that's always going to happen. But the point is that one should be praising Krishna for everything. Not just thanking him for the things that we like. I mean, those of us who have children, we know that if we're good parents, we try to do the best thing for our children in all circumstances, but sometimes the children appreciate it and sometimes they don't. And what we wish would happen, and it doesn't usually happen, but what we wish would happen is that our children would thank us for the things that are difficult for them. You know, thank you for making me do extra homework on this thing I was having trouble with. Thank you for making me wait till after dinner till I could have a cookie. Thank you for taking away the fire truck when I was hitting my brother over the head with it. You know? And they don't usually do that. Maybe they do it once they're 30. But they don't usually do that when they're 6. But that's what we wish that they would do. So that's also what Krishna wishes that we would do. That we would praise him for everything. And then this last one is a little difficult. I was saying in the beginning that a lot of our obstacles are created by ourselves. So we accept, at least in theory, this concept of the law of karma, that whatever I'm getting back is something that I'm giving out. Whatever I'm experiencing is something that I'm doing to others. Now you might notice I'm using the present tense. Sometimes we think about karma as something that will happen to other people so they'll get what they deserve, especially when they hurt us. Oh, they'll get their karma. And when it's happening to us, we generally think, oh, this must be something bad that I did in another lifetime. In the Brahma Samhita, it says, Yasvindra Gopa Matavendra Mahoswa Karma Bandhanu Rupa Palambhaja Namata Noti Karmadi Nirdahati Kintu Chabakti Bhaja. When Bhibhishan came to surrender to Lord Ramachandra, everyone except for Hanuman said, don't accept him. He's a demon. And some of the monkeys even said, look, he's disloyal to his own brother. How can you trust him? And Lord Ramachandra said, if somebody one time surrenders unto me, it doesn't matter who they are, what they are, I accept them. And he says, and if the person one time asks me for courage, I immediately give courage to that person. And they become my personal ward. The Lord is in Singhadeva also makes a similar comment. So as soon as we have even one time said, my dear Lord, from this day on I am yours, I surrender to you, I want to serve you. From that moment, karmadi nirdahati kintu chabakti bhajam, we're no longer under just the law of karma. But the law of karma is meant to rectify things in the heart. If I steal from someone, that means I don't have any empathy for them, right? I'm envious. When I was at Ernst & Young, it was really funny. One of the people there said, isn't it all right to steal from the rich and give to the poor? I thought, should I tell all your rich clients that you said this? You can tell all your clients, by the way. Another thing I was thinking, which I didn't say, when I was thinking, okay, why are you in this business? Don't you want to be rich? I'll bet you everybody who works there wants to be rich. I doubt that anyone who works as a financial planner and financial investor wants to just live on the bare necessities of life. I really doubt it. And I was thinking, don't you want to be rich? So then when you're rich, somebody will want to steal from you and give to the poor? So it's envy. If you're stealing it, you're envious. You know, why is that person rich? I wish I had some of that money. Let me try to cheat them. And it's a lack of empathy. How will this person feel if somebody steals from them? So the real problem with stealing is envy and lack of empathy. That's the real problem, and the whole idea of karma is so you rectify those things. And generally, the way you rectify them is you get to experience them. You get to feel what it's like to have somebody steal from you, or have somebody cheat on you, or have somebody insult you. Right. Sometimes you see this instantly. I knew one person who went to someone they were angry at and said, I'm going to ruin your reputation. I'm going to tell everybody you did this. I'm going to go around doing this and this and this and this. And he didn't even do it. He just threatened it. And about 2 years later, that's what happened to him. The whole list that he had threatened this person with, they didn't even do. It all happened to him. And then you know what it feels like. And when it happened to him, then he went back to this other person. He said, boy, I'm really sorry. So karma is meant to have you have that experience so you develop, oh, that's why I shouldn't do that. So, but once you decide you want to surrender to God, once you decide you want to be a spiritual person, often you develop much of this empathy and much of this good quality. So if you've already developed the empathy, if you've already developed the satisfaction, then why do you need to have the lesson anymore? You don't. But if there's something that you haven't changed in the heart, for that you have to have a lesson. Therefore, people who've taken up the spiritual path, if they're getting some supposed karma, that means there's something we're doing now. Some defect in my own heart now, some defect in my own thinking now. Now, of course, we tend to think, well, I don't have any defects in my thinking. I'm a good person. I'm caring and loving and selfless. And I don't hurt anybody. So my suggestion is that if the obstacles in your life are coming from the way other people are dealing with you, Any of you have those kind of obstacles? No? You never have obstacles in the way other people are dealing with you. If you ever have obstacles in the way other people are dealing with you, my suggestion is that you talk to God and say, please show me how I'm treating somebody else like this. And 98, 99% of the time, I found that that's the case. And it may not be exactly in the same form. So if someone's being inconsiderate to you in one way, you may not be inconsiderate in that way. You may be inconsiderate in another way. And you may be inconsiderate in another way with other people. So if person A is inconsiderate of you, that they're always late, maybe you're always on time, but maybe you're inconsiderate of person B in another way. And if you ask the Lord, if you say, please show me how I am treating someone in the way that I'm being treated, then he'll show you. And it will be a very humbling experience. And if you can think of some of our obstacles like that as a mirror, as a way to say, how can I change things in myself? So I see that if we respond to obstacles like that, yes, we can try to adjust the circumstances up to a point, but don't think that by adjusting the circumstances, I'll be happy. And don't think I'll ever be able to adjust the circumstances to make it perfect. Not putting our energy into having a perfect situation. And to think, all right, I will put some energy into adjusting my circumstances, but what service can I do with the circumstances that I have? What can I do with the circumstances that I have? How can I use the situation that I'm in to meditate more on the pleasure of the Lord rather than my own comfort? And how can I use the situation to look within my heart and see what I need to change within my heart? And if one does that, then all of one's obstacles, as Prabhupada said, will be changed to spiritual service. Because really the obstacles are meant to bring us to a higher level. So I didn't bring one with me. Do any of you have a pen or a pencil I could just borrow for a second? Okay. So I was a teacher for many years, and one thing that we do with very little children who don't hold their pencil properly is we have a little device we put on the pencil. Because research has shown that if you hold a writing implement like this, of course nowadays mostly we type, but if you hold a writing implement like this, you can write for a longer period of time with neat handwriting without your hand becoming tired. But a lot of kids come to school and they're holding their pencil like this or some sort of odd something. So first you try to get the child to hold it properly, but maybe they've spent 3 or 4 years holding it like this. And some of them will change, but some of them won't. So there's this little rubber thing that you could put on a pencil, and it has indentations in it that sort of force you to put your fingers in the right place. So we put that on the child's pencil. Now, what do you think that the children often do when we put that on their pencil? They take it off. Sometimes they'll have two pencils, one with it on and one with it off. Okay, what else do they do?
Put it in their mouth.
Put in their mouth, chew it, yeah. They also will try to go around it. They'll sometimes push it up on their pencil and put their fingers around it. Okay. Now, if they want us to take it off their pencil, what should they do?
Stop.
Yeah. So, the irony is, if they want us to take it off their pencil, they have to accept it. The more they try to take it off their pencil, the more we're going to keep putting it on. The closer we're going to supervise them. We'll have them sit up in the front. Now remember, we're doing this for them. We're doing it for them because we're thinking this is someone their whole life. We want them to be able to write without tiredness and legibly. We don't care for ourselves. We already know how to write. We're doing it for their benefit. And if they want to get it off, the way they have to get it off is to accept that it's there.
How did we do manage to get hers off?
Once they accept that it's there and they work with it and they allow that device to train them, we're going to take it off. So from the child's perspective, it's an obstacle. From the teacher's perspective, it's a training device. So practically, the obstacles in our life are all like that. And ultimately, they're all also self-created. Because originally we were in the spiritual world where there was no obstacles, and we chose to come to this place where there's obstacles. So if we see our obstacles like that, that ultimately they're all self-created, and that they're meant to reform us, and that if we want the obstacles to be gone, the best way to do it is in many cases not to just try to get rid of them, but to try to see what they're meant to teach us. Obviously, if there's simple things you can get rid of, get rid of them. It's not that if you have a TV in your house, you say, now what's this TV supposed to teach me? Just throw it out the window. That's the best place for televisions. But if you're living with other people who are going to insist on the television, then you have to think, okay, now what's this meant to teach? All right, what is meditation, you ask me? Ultimately, the ultimate meditation is that you withdraw all your senses from the external life and you have one focused meditation on the Lord. Your mind is totally focused on the Lord. That's ultimate meditation. What I was talking about was simply internal mental imagery. So it is late. Questions, comments? Yes?
Is it because we've labeled everything since childhood as a conditioning, good and bad, so we have great difficulty?
I mean, not just since childhood, for many lifetimes
yes.
We've labeled everything good and bad.
That's why we have difficulty even with Krishna, because that's good and that's bad.
Well, that's one of the difficulties. That's the function of the mind, is labeling things good and bad. And the mind labels things good or bad as to what's going to facilitate our plan for material enjoyment. And the mind is often wrong, by the way. Have you ever thought something would be good for your enjoyment and it wasn't? Or you thought something would be bad for your enjoyment and it was actually good for your enjoyment? So the mind isn't always able to figure that out. But yeah, we tend to do that also in spiritual life. Now, to some extent, we should say, I'm going to try to arrange my life to facilitate my Krishna consciousness. But please don't put all your energy there. You know, it's like then you'll be spending all of your time arranging the table and you never cook the meal. So to some extent, sure, you go shopping to try to get the ingredients you want. And to some extent, you have to cook with what you have. You know, just imagine if you spend all of your time ordering stuff from Argentina and China and... Meanwhile, your guests go hungry. In one sense, ultimately everything here is bad. In another sense, ultimately everything here is good. You can use everything in this world to remind you of Krishna, and you can use everything in this world to help you become closer to Krishna. Anything else? Did you have a question?
Yes, yeah. She does a round. She's got a bead with about 27 beads on it.
Okay.
And she does three of them a day.
Okay. Very nice. How old are you? Six? Is that what you said? Wow.
And she says she's going to do them later, but sometimes she forgets. And she actually made a promise to Jaini Dai, the president of Salt Street, that she's going to do them. So she wants to do them.
I don't know if six-year-olds should make promises. I don't think that's a very good idea. I don't think that's a very good idea. I think till somebody's at least 12 or so, just whatever they can do is nice. That's my own opinion, having dealt with hundreds of kids. I don't think it's a good idea to have kids make promises till they're at least 12.
She loves trying more when it's happening.
Well, that's good. That's nice. At least chant a little every day. Okay, that's good. That's all right. My own feeling is it's a lot more important for children to have happy experiences with chanting.
We put them on their heads all the time.
Goni Thai come off the altar themselves when you show up. I'm coming to your house. I'm going to come chant with you guys. A most important thing for young children is just that they find spiritual life enjoyable. That's much more important for very young children than that they have to do this every day and that every day. I wouldn't have said that 30 years ago, but I'm seeing that it's a lot more important. You want them to think, wow, I really had fun chanting japa with my daddy. Not like, oh, my daddy made me chant japa. Where's your beads? You promised. Not a good idea. Sorry. I don't think that was the answer you wanted. I know one kid who, he's now 11, almost 12. And he's gone, sometimes he's chanted 16 rounds a day for months and months and months and months and months, and then he'll just stop. And months he doesn't chant any rounds. And then he'll start again. And he's, I think the most rounds he chanted was like 150 one Janmashtami. And one time he told me, he said, when I grow up, I just want to chant all day. But he's not able to be steady. And his parents, I think very wisely, just leave him alone. I mean, he goes off and on like that. But he's just a kid. You know, he gets to be, I mean, he's not even 12 yet. I don't know, I could see maybe 14, 15, 16 saying, hey, you know, maybe you'd like to do something steady instead of sometimes 16, sometimes 150, and sometimes none. But I'd be very careful, especially with japa. Be very careful about pushing. What's nice with kids, you know, say, okay, we're going to have 2 minutes of japa every day and just have it fun. It took me a long road to come to that conclusion. It wasn't something that I started, it wasn't the way I started out thinking. But what I saw practically. Especially japa.
What about using like family members to kind of be stronger for them, because it's more, it gives you more strength.
What do you mean?
So it's my daughter or my missus, if I'm, my meditation is, if I'm stronger, okay, at least I'll be happy with them. So it's kind of like reverse psychology of myself.
That's like a very good idea. Not just stronger, but happy. Everyone's attracted to happy people. So if you're like, I'm really strong about chanting my rounds every day, and you should be too. That's, yeah. I mean, I know of one man who destroyed his children's interest in Krishna consciousness by being very heavy all the time. But so being very strong and also very happy and being a nice person. I mean, basically you want to be the kind of person that your family members and your friends look at you and say, I'd like to be like that. What do you do?
I thought once about people come down to us and ask them similar questions. And he said similar what you said, but he said, do not marry poppy.
Put sugar in their mouth while they chant. I mean, definitely you can say, okay, this is the time of day we're all going to sit down and have a little kirtan. You don't have to worry quite as much about kirtan as you do about japa, because a kirtan is much more, thank you, it's much easier for the children and family members to enjoy kirtan. Because even on a material level, it's very pleasing because music and things like that. But you can say, this is our time to get together and have our little program every day. And you can say, okay, you know, if you don't want to participate, that's fine, but you need to be here. You can't be off playing with your toys. And then try to make it fun. And try yourself to be a happy person and a kind person. Yes?
You said earlier that parents generally advise children to get good education, good job, good house, good car. What's one advice that you would give to parents when you're, you know, lecturing and giving speeches? What would you advise parents to advise their children to follow, if, you know, those advices that they give them, or, you know, what would you advise them to advise their children to be a better, I don't know, Krishna consciousness experience rather than going off to university, jobs, grades?
I don't think it's an either or, but you want to look at what is it we want to do all those things for? Why do people want to go to the best universities and get the best job and have the best house? What do we want all that for? What are we looking for? What are we looking for? Happiness. First thing we're all looking for is happiness. We want to be happy. What else are we looking for? Security. We don't want to feel safe. We're looking for peace. But we're also looking for excitement. We don't want just peace. We don't want just excitement. We want some excitement and some peace. We want to do something that's meaningful. We want to feel that we're doing something that's significant, that's important, that means something. We want to have some meaning in our life. We want to have some love in our life. Love, affection. We want to have good communication. We want to be in an atmosphere where there's a mood of respect and consideration, understanding. What other things do we want? We want some beauty and some harmony. We want things to be genuine. We want our relationships to be genuine. So that's what we want. Okay. Now, let's just look at materialistic scientific research. Materialistic scientific research says that once you have the basic necessities of life, having opulence over and above that does not increase any of those things. That's what the research says. That having more money, that having more status in society, that having a degree from Oxford doesn't increase your happiness, your security, your peace, it doesn't increase any of those. That's what the research said. That was materialistic research. Not research done by spiritual people or religious people. From a material point of view, guess what increases those things? When I'm talking about spirituality, guess what increases those things? Yes, you know, you want to have the bare necessities of life. You want to make sure you have a home and bed and some food to eat. But once you have your basic physical needs taken care of, what is it that increases things like happiness and security and peace and excitement and meaning and authenticity and what kind of things? Good relationships. What else? Trust. That's all relationships. What gives us things like trust and love? Good relationships. What else? Doing charity work. Doing some work that benefits others. Giving of yourself. Some sort of, you know, volunteer work or something where you're giving yourself to others. Those are the kind of things, just speaking materially, we're not even speaking spiritually. Those are the kind of things that give you what you want. Then what to speak of it once we get into the spiritual realm? Really, the only way to get those things is through spiritual realization. I can only get full security when I realize that I'm a soul. Because on the material level, my body and mind are subject to diseases, accidents, my house, everything. And the only truly satisfying relationship I'm going to have is with God, and I'm only going to have fully satisfying relationships with other living beings if I first have my satisfaction with God. And the best humanitarian work is humanitarian work which is connected with spirituality. So what I'd say to children is, you better put that first. You know, it's interesting that in schools, although that research is there and everybody knows about it, how many classes in schools are about developing good relationships? Unbelievable. Did you ever have a class on how to have a happy marriage? Madness, isn't it? I bet you had classes on all kinds of things that were much more useful. Like how to figure out the volume of a sphere. You use that a lot in your life, I would assume. Or the difference between the ectoplasm and the rhizoplasm and the... I mean, I'm sure some of us use that, but I don't. I don't remember what it is. I was a teacher. You know, we spend all of our time memorizing the different parts of a cell, right? Didn't you all do that? Mm-hmm. And we don't have a class on how to be a good wife and how to be a good husband, how to be a good parent. Unbelievable. And in the modern schools, you know, they'll tell you classes on how not to have babies, but they won't tell you classes on how to have babies. How to have a healthy labor and birth, how to take care of your children. Crazy society. Madness. Absolute madness. So all these years studying things, which A, half of which we don't even use at all for anything, and B, and if we did use them, wouldn't increase our happiness by their own studies. And we don't spend any time studying the things that even materially would make us happy. Is that crazy? Crazy. So, what I would advise parents is make sure that you spend at least as much time and energy on the things that are really going to make a difference in your kids' life. Sure, we all want our kids to have a decent home and a decent source of income and be able to earn an honest livelihood in a way that uses their abilities and their talents. Nobody wants their kids to be, you know, on the dole or living out of cardboard boxes. But is it really important to you that your kid becomes a millionaire and is famous all over the world? I mean, is that really important to you? Is that really going to add to your children's happiness or your children's satisfaction in life? Or it isn't. It just isn't from any perspective. You see, you know, everyone has their abilities, everyone has their inclinations. If you have a child who's got, you know, an inclination for science, then yeah, you know, send them to the best school and have them learn the different parts of a cell, because that's what they're going to do. And if they're not, have them learn the skills where they'll be happy in life. But everyone should know, I mean, those are the things I'd really focus on. Materially speaking, how to get along with other people, how to get along in a family, how to have empathy, how to give to others, how to give to others of your time, of your energy, of your money, and how to give your heart to God. And sure, you know, you got to live in the world. You want to do something that's interesting, and you want to do something that's satisfying. But if you have a job that's interesting and satisfying and uses your psychology and you have enough money to live without a lot of anxiety, that's enough. And frankly, if it's their destiny to be rich, they're going to be rich. Don't need to worry about it. And if it's not their destiny to be rich, they're not going to be rich, and you don't need to worry about that either. There you go. Is that all right? In running a school, you know, I had to deal with people from all different backgrounds, and one friend of mine sent me a link to a YouTube video called Indian Parents. And that's real. I really dealt with Indian parents. So if you go to YouTube and type in Indian Parents, and it shows the couple in the kitchen, and they're wearing their bathrobes. So that's how you know you got the right one. I probably watched it 5 times. I was cracking up each time. Please don't be like that. Anyway, you can watch that. I wish I had it here to show you.
Yeah, but I watched it, but I thought it was a bit exaggerated.
It's not!
He's an Indian parent.
I had a kid in my school, 7 years old. And the father came to meet with me, and he brought the head of the temple. And he said, I'm really worried about my son. What's the problem? He said, well, you know, I want him to get a master's degree. I said, that's nice, but right now he's 7. This really happened, okay? I wish I'd videoed it. And he said, I'm really concerned because my son's got a failing grade in spelling. How will he get a master's degree if he got a failing grade in spelling? And I said, you know, no university is going to look at his grades when he's 7. It's not going to be on his record. Anyway, then I pulled out all the records and all of his reports. He had excellent in spelling. I said, he didn't fail anything in spelling. One test he's failed. And I had to go through the files and find there was one test out of, 100 that he had failed. It didn't even end up on the report card grade. It was an excellent. He took his kid out of the school because he failed one spelling test. And he was afraid he wouldn't get a master's degree. So no, that movie is not an exaggeration. And I can tell you something, that was just one of several stories that I had. Like, I had similar experiences with Chinese parents. So, is that all right? Okay, yes. Well, Prabhupada talks about saving 25%, that the ideal is if you can save 25% for emergencies. That's the ideal. Of course, then you may have to change, you change either your income or your outgo. So generally, we look at changing our income, but you can also change your outgo. So if you want to save something for the future, which another way you can do it is decreasing your standard of living now, decreasing your spending now.
25%
I'm going to tell you. I'm going to tell you something. I'm going to tell you something that you're probably not going to want to hear, and you're probably going to think it's completely impractical. But I'm just going to say it anyway, and you can ignore it. The person who's maintaining us is Krishna. Now you can. We do have a duty to make proper plans. We do have a duty to manage whatever money that we get in an intelligent and rational way, and part of that management is putting something aside for emergencies. That's our duty. However, our mood should be, Krishna is going to take care of all of my needs all the time. He may not take care of my needs in exactly the way that I think he should take care of my needs. Just like children don't always like the way their parents take care of their needs. But Krishna will take care of my needs. Always. All the time. And Mare Krishna Rake Ke, Rake Krishna Mare Ke. Krishna wants to save you, no one can kill you. Krishna wants to kill you, no one can save you. If Krishna wants me to be taken care of in my old age, I will be. And if Krishna doesn't want me to be, I won't be. So I do my duty. It's not that you don't do your duty. It's not that you just become a bum and you say, well, whatever Krishna wants. You do your duty, but without attachment to the results. Fight for the sake of fighting without considering gain or loss, victory or defeat. The results are not under our control. Have you ever noticed that? They're just not. My parents told me how during the Depression, my father was telling me how one of his uncles, he had been a very, very wealthy man, and when the Depression hit, 1929, 1930, he lost everything. And he went to his wife and said, "We have nothing." And she said, "Well, I haven't told you all these years, but I've been putting aside some cash." And she opened up a drawer. She had $50,000, which today would be like $500,000. And he used that and started again. But, you know, you can save and then something happens in the economy and it's all gone. Or there can be a war. You know, we think, oh, there won't be a war. You know, it happens. You read the stories about people in Germany. They're taking wheelbarrows of money just to buy a loaf of bread. All your savings can become worthless. Your land can become worthless. The government can take your land. There can be a war and another country can take your land. It happens, right? It doesn't happen. A natural disaster can take everything, you know, like that tsunami that was there a couple years ago. Guys went out fishing, they came back, and everything was gone. Their wife, their 11 kids, their mother, their father, their home, everything was just gone. It was just them and their boat. And it can work the other way, too. Prabhupada says Krishna has 10 hands. He can give you more with the 10 hands than you can hold, and he can take away more with the 10 hands than you can hold on to. So you do your duty, but what you're attached to is pleasing Krishna and serving Krishna. And that means to be able to look at it and say, okay, let's say my worst scene scenario happened. What's the most terrible thing that can happen? My whole family could die. I could be a quadriplegic, living on the street, on a piece of cardboard, eating out of garbage cans. So first of all, that's not likely to happen. So you really don't need to stress about it. The chances of that happening are one in a gazillion. And if that's what Krishna thinks is what's best for you, then, you know, then you just pick up the lotus flower in the lake and say, okay, Krishna, what can I do in this circumstance? And if I'm in that circumstance, but I'm swimming in love of God and I'm in unlimited transcendental ecstasy and I'm hardly even aware of the external world, then who cares anyway? What does it matter? If I'm meditating on Radha and Krishna in Vrindavan and in my internal heart, I'm there in the spiritual world, then what do I care if I'm lying in a cardboard box on the street as a quadriplegic and everybody hates me? Who cares? Doesn't matter. If you have that mentality, then you're always peaceful. If you can look at your worst fears and laugh at them and just say, oh, so what? Fight Krishna, it's okay. Then you're always happy. And then you do your duty peacefully, whatever it may be. We have different duties according to our varna and ashram. You do your duty peacefully, without worrying. If you do that, will you always have enough money? Will you always have a nice house? I don't know. But you'll always be happy and peaceful. And if you try to control everything, will you always have enough money and a nice house? I don't know. But you'll always be in anxiety. Does that help? Some of you really might not like to hear that. Yes?
You made some really good points. But sometimes you say there is a conflict in a modern society. Now, if we take an attitude that no matter what obstacles one's going through, you surrender yourself to Krishna and say, fine, Krishna's going to take care of all my problems, does that not create a feeling of weakness within you? To that sort of like, I spent about a year in India a couple of years ago, and you know, the amount of poverty I saw was so terrifying, really. And when I was talking to a lot of these people, they just accepted that as a destiny. This is where it was meant to be. And then on the other side, like if we look at the Western society, you know, there is this thing called the secret or the law of attraction. What they say is that you yourself can create your destiny. So how do you reconcile between these two extreme facts?
Well, it's nice to have somebody who asks good questions. I'm wondering. It's interesting if you look at the symptoms of someone who's in the mode of goodness. One of the symptoms of someone who's in the mode of goodness is unbreakable enthusiasm and determination. So someone who's in the mode of goodness is not attached to the fruit, is not thinking that they're the controller, they're not thinking that they're the doer, but they always have enthusiasm and determination. Srila Prabhupada said that we should combine the best of India and the best of the West. He compared it to a blind man and a lame man. He said India is lame and the West is blind. So you have a combination. So I think just like here in London, we see many things that are very good. I mean, if you want to compare London and India, and I was just in India for 3 months, London's a lot cleaner and it's a lot better organized. It is. There's a lot more of the rule of law. I once asked some Indian people, what do you like best about the West? They said that people follow the law more. I mean, frankly, we're more together here, aren't we? It's very frustrating in India to try to get anything done. On the positive side, you become very patient. Either that or you're insane.
Now, what I found was patient is like they accept it, you know? So.
But there's some good to that.
Yeah.
Some of the downside of the West is we want everything yesterday perfectly. And it boils over into a lot of anger and frustration in the society in general. So it has its good sides and its bad sides. What I'd like to see is that we really have this combination of blind man and lame man. I'd love to bring real spirituality to the West, and I'd love to bring efficiency and order and cleanliness to India. That'd be really nice. Now, some parts of India are like that. Have you been to Tirumala? In the south?
Yes, I did.
I was there about 25 years ago. That's a very clean, orderly place. Beautiful, very beautiful place. So it's possible. I mean, you can see that, unfortunately, it was Britain who came and robbed India of its wealth and tried to destroy Indian culture. And the places where the British and other influences were the greatest are the places now that's really the most suffering. I think if we had to use what happens in modern India as evidence of spirituality, it wouldn't be very attractive. I hope I'm not offending anybody by saying that. No. I would agree with you. I would say also that most of the people that I meet in India don't really understand their own spiritual culture. So I don't know if we can take... I mean, a few years ago, I lived 3 months in an Indian village. And I would say that the people there have lost their spiritual culture. They don't even know what their philosophy is anymore. It's more like a remnant of their philosophy. So if I had to judge this spiritual process by what happens in India today, I don't think that I'd accept it. As far as does accepting things make you fatalistic? No. Someone in the mode of goodness has unbreakable enthusiasm and determination. Because they're, especially in transcendental life, you're working out of love. You're not working for the result anymore. I'm working because I love Krishna. The result is his business. I'm enjoying the process so much that I give my heart and soul to it at every moment. If I think that I'm the doer, and I think that I'm the controller, kartaham iti manyate. First of all, logically, I'm not the doer and the controller. whether on the external platform or through some sort of envisioning like The Secret, I'm not the absolute controller. I mean, they'll say, well, if you don't get your shiny red car, you just didn't want it badly enough. Whatever. I'm not absolutely the controller. I mean, maybe sometimes if I meditate on a diamond necklace, my boyfriend will give it to me, but, you know, sometimes he might not. Or you just didn't do it right. Well, that's what the external materialists say, too. I mean, it's the same thing. You know, you just got to get a better job, and you just got to get more money, and you just didn't do it right. You just didn't marry the right person. You just didn't go to the right school. You just didn't get the right job. And these other people say, you're just not meditating right. We're not the controllers and the doers of the material nature. You can't control the result. What you can control is your mood at every moment. So if your happiness in life is tied to the result you get, you're going to be a very frustrated person. Because that means your happiness is tied to something over which you have no control, or very little control. You have some influence. But you don't have. Can anyone here absolutely control the results of their activities? Can you do it? What the secret people are looking for, really, is they're looking for some of the cities. They're looking for the mystic powers. So that's another one of the carrots. You know, well, if you can't do it through getting a degree at Oxford and becoming a doctor or a rock and roll star, you know, do it through mystic manipulation of the material energy. But none of us are absolute at controlling the material energy. We're one of several factors. Even if you have mystic powers, you're not absolutely controlling the material energy. And even if you could perfectly get what you want, would it always make you happy? Haven't we also had this experience? We work for something and we had in mind, this is what I want, this is what I want, and you get it, and after you get it, you go, why did I work hard for this? This wasn't what I wanted. Haven't you had that experience? Save up your money, you order it, and you get it. It's like, this isn't what I wanted. Just talking to a girl like this, you know, went to university, she went to law school, and after she became a lawyer, she said, I don't like being a lawyer. So first of all, you can't always control the results, and second of all, the results may not even give you what you want. So accepting that everything that's coming is being directed by God doesn't mean that you're not active. You're very active. You're more active, actually, because you're getting an inspiration at every moment. And of course, you'd like to see the external success because you're doing it for Krishna, but that's not in your hands. I'm working on this project, and I should have brought some with me, and I didn't do it. Anyway, working on this project to create a learning to read English program that has Krishna conscious stories. And when we were about a third of the way through it, we met a publisher here in London who showed us that we could put sound in the book. So if you touch the book with a special pen, you hear the book. I showed you last time. Yeah, I didn't bring it this with me this time. Anyway, we're doing it so that you can hear the book in one of 25 languages. So you touch the page with this pen and you can hear it in English and in Hindi and in Gujarati and French and Russian and Italian. We've been working on this for about 3 years. And all the time that we're working on it, I'm thinking, I don't know if it's going to happen or not. When we just met with the publisher, he said, so who's paying for the printing? I said, I don't know. He said, well, I guess you're asking us to pay for the printing, and you're hoping you're going to sell enough to pay us back? I said, yeah, I guess so. I said, I want to make sure you get paid back. I said, I don't know what will happen if we don't sell enough. So I don't know. It may not happen. I mean, I was just really saying to Krishna, I said, Krishna, you know, if you want to smash me personally, that's fine. You've done that so many times already, you know, it's okay. We'll do that again. I'm not going anywhere. But look at all these other people that we've been helping, you know. I don't want to disappoint them. I don't want them to help. And they're just going to say, oh, I gave all my time and things just sitting on a computer and nobody's using it. You know, and I don't know how it's going to happen. Maybe it won't happen. But I'll tell you what, it's been a lot of fun. It's really been a lot of fun. You know, just sitting there and writing stories about Krishna. And it's been great fun. And we've all worked really, 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 really hard. I think that there's probably about 200 people so far has contributed to the project. And I think that many of us have worked a lot harder than somebody would work as a job. Nobody paid us. You've had more energy, and it may not even happen. Who knows? Maybe you'll just be sitting on my computer forever. That'd be a shame. Well, I've decided if we can't print it, I'll just put it on the internet and let people download it, but then we'll lose all the sound and everything. That's my plan C. Does that make sense? Whether it happens or not is not under my control. I can't control it. Even if I had 100,000 pounds in my pocket, I still can't control it. So many things could happen. We could have all the books on a ship and the ship could sink. I mean, who knows? You know, so many things could happen. And we have copies in different places. You know, there's one on my son's server in California, there's another one on my other son's server in Hawaii. I've got it on my backed up external drive and on my computer, so at least four places, but they could all blow up. Who knows, you know? Hare Krishna. I can't control that. But that doesn't mean I just sit down going, well, you know, Krishna, if you want to learn to read program, you're just going to have to manifest it from the sky. I'm working really, 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 really hard. But it's fun. I'm having fun. Does that make some sense? And that's true for everything. That's true whether you're training your kid, or whether you're working at the law office, or whether you're washing the dishes, or you're driving your car. You do it with full enthusiasm. I'm doing this for Krishna. 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 I'm sure you can envision it being successful. I do that all the time. I envision all the books being done and being put on the altar in front of the deities. And I think about Radha and Krishna looking them over. And Radharani saying to Krishna, look at this funny story. Seriously. And I envision them being offered to Prabhupada, Prabhupada smiling. But when I'm doing that in the mind, you know what? That means it's already done. Do you understand? Because Krishna accepts mental offerings the same as he accepts physical offerings. So if you're trying to build a new temple and you envision it already being done, like they tell you to do in the secret, that you're already successful.
It's not in abundance,
rather. Yeah, you're already successful. Whether it's successful externally or not, you know, that's not your business. You just work for the company. That's company president's business. That's not your business. Mm-hmm. We work more enthusiastically. Materialistic people, they're working for this or that. So no, we don't want to be just like, oh, you know, I'm not going to pick up the trash on the side of the road because it's Krishna's mercy the trash is on the side of the road. That's not our philosophy. Does that help at all? That's a long answer, 10-minute answer. We could probably talk about that for a few hours. What was that?
Maybe next time you can have a whole day.
We can have at least a month on that. A few years on how to fix India. Oh, thank you. We're trying. I think that many of us in ISKCON were really trying to bring back to India's own glory and spirituality. And we're finding that in India, the Indians in India who've really taken up the genuine spiritual practices are not like that. They're not lethargic, they're not dirty, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And we're finding in our communities that that's changing, and we're setting that example. So we're trying to set the example in India of both Indians in India who've taken up their own culture. And since Indians are looking to people like me are taking up their culture. That was Prabhupada's idea. Oh, so American ladies doing it? Oh, maybe it's the thing to do. You know? Anything else? So anything I've said that you think is foolish, just ignore it. Or impractical. If I've said anything at all that you find helpful, and then I hope that you can take it on board, put it into practice. And I should have said this at the beginning, but I'm sure you've all noticed that I'm an American, and I hope that you will excuse me for my crude American ways. I know that by British culture and by Indian culture, but to speak of by British Indian culture, I am very uncivilized. And I've tried to change, but it's not going to happen in this life. Something like dyeing your hair and the roots always show. So, I really have tried, and I got to a point that I gave up, and I said, you know, whatever I am in this life, that's what I am. Oh, well, sorry about that. But I do apologize. I'm sure I've said something crude or uncivilized that offended somebody, and I hope that you will excuse me. So thank you very much. Oh, yes, one more question? Yes. Yes?
You said she's got your book at home. Thank you for that.
Oh, which one do you have?
Krishna.
Oh, Krishna is. You have that one. Well, we're going to be coming out with 42 books. Actually, we're coming out with 42 color books. 42 color books. Like what you have, but better, because there'll be sound in them. And 42 black and white activity books. So, yeah, and if anybody wants to help with that, you can. It's okay. You really can help. Okay. Yeah, please do. Well, we could use some...